The 1999 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session 236. More Light or Heat? A conversation with Albert Peck about sunstone. With the interviewers, Brian Cagle and Brian Waterman.
We can get started. Glad to have you all out here for Sunstone Fest 99. You've come to Albert Unplugged, or Unhinged, depending on how you want to look at it. What you're about to see is completely unscripted. He is dancing on a tightrope with no real safety net here. Initially, when we talked about this idea, he wanted to sit down with us with a studio audience and videotape it and then just show you the videotape with the laugh track and, you know, the editing and everything. And Waterman and I have, well, a lot of professional integrity, and we absolutely... flat out said no way would we bow to that, even though he put a lot of pressure on us. So if we seem a little emotionally rattled, that's why the beating emotionally he gave us on that. The reason we're here talking to Albert is we're dear friends. We've worked with him for a long time. Waterman is a PhD candidate at Boston College. Is that right? Oh, sorry. Boston University, I guess that is, signature. Oh, Gary, sorry about that. I've got a journalism background, and hopefully this can be entertaining and enlightening. To level the playing field here, we've given Albert 3 get-out-of-jail cards. If he wants to pass on 3 questions, he can do so. Use them judiciously. A few clarifying points, before we launch into a very brief historical sketch as to what brought Albert to this point here at Sunstone, 13 years, and then the rest of the conversation will focus on Sunstone and the issues and Albert. First of all, it's been rumored that your given name was Thomas or Jeff or something like that, and that you chose Albert because it was less conspicuous. How do you respond to that?
Well,
what's your given name?
I want to distance myself from Thomas Jefferson as much as possible.
Okay, good.
Oh. We're all friends here. Okay.
So for the record, your given name is?
Albert Eugene Peck.
Okay, great. People are rather unclear as to whether you're in your 50s or in your 60s. Can I get a birth date?
I was born February 20th.
You have 2 cards left. All right. Okay. Okay. Briefly now, historical sketch. What I want you to do during this period is to look for patterns, and I'll help, point them out along the way, but look for patterns. And Albert, feel free to chime in at will.
Okay.
But please know that we hold the power. You grew up in Washington, D.C. You were a churchy kid. You sat on the committee that actually censored music for your church dances. True?
No. I was chair of the youth committee that scheduled the church dances. It was the advisors who censored me.
A distinction without a difference. Okay, issue 1, censorship. You went to BYU. Why?
It was no choice. I mean,
okay, you couldn't get in anywhere else?
Yeah, that's it.
Okay,
it's the only
it was
place
a given.
I applied, yeah.
Okay, the only place you applied. You were there when you were 20. You left on your mission. 20. Don't most people go when they're 19? You were late.
Yeah.
Another issue to keep censorship late.
2 patterns.
Okay, 2 patterns. Your mission was in split between time in California and Las Vegas. Is that right?
Correct.
Had some leadership positions there. You were AP. You were trained greenies, all that stuff.
Yeah. The one greenie I trained left the mission in the middle of it.
I don't think I really need to comment on that one. You went back to BYU, where you completed a bachelor's degree and a master's degree in very timely fashion. Did the two take you about 12 years? What was it?
No. 4 years for my undergraduate.
Okay.
Degree. 3 years to complete a 2-year master's program.
Okay.
Because the first year I just quit in the middle of it.
All right. Yeah. Okay. That was actually, thank you, another pattern I wanted to point out. Not necessarily quitting, but, well, yeah, quitting. Fleeing. Fleeing from difficult situations. Pattern 3.
Yeah. The Rechabite tradition is what Hugh Nibley calls it.
Okay. While you were at BYU, during that time you established the Seventh East Press.
I was one of the founders.
Yeah,
of it.
Yeah, part of that team, right? You were the editor there, is that right?
Mm-hmm,
that's
mm-hmm.
your role. While you were at the Seventh East Press, you know, this publication had a lot of controversy and probably put out its issues, you know, quite late. True?
Of course.
Pattern. Okay, you fled the Seventh East Press.
That's true.
Okay, you fled the Seventh East Press for Sunstone Review, correct?
Yeah, well, they were paying me money.
Okay. The point is you fled. You landed there at the Seventh East Press with Peggy, Sunstone Review,
mm-hmm.
Put together more controversial late issues. Is that correct?
I don't know how controversial they were.
But late?
But late.
Okay. After that, you fled to Washington, D.C.
No, I didn't flee.
You didn't?
No.
Okay, you didn't flee. You went to Washington, D.C., where you bummed around a couple of years, then got into city planning.
Correct.
Is that right? Yeah. And then you were recruited back to Sunstone.
Yeah, while in Washington, I planned the first regional symposium, and when Peggy said she was leaving, I came back to be the editor.
Okay.
Reluctantly.
Yeah. So that brings us to this point. You've now been here 13 years. You haven't fled. We're glad you haven't. Let's talk about the time that you've been here.
Okay.
I'm going to go ahead and sit down, and Waterman and I. Yeah. Y'all have any questions at this point? Pattern's pretty clear in your minds. We're going to be referring to them.
Just keep a checklist.
Well, this was just supposed to be an overview. Generally, I have a hard time stopping talking.
Our idea is that we'd give you a brief historical sketch, you know, some of the high points that led him to Sunstone, some of the patterns that you'll see repeated over and over again. And then a lot of this narrative that you're talking about, Elbert's history, will certainly come out as we discuss larger issues and ideas in relation to Sunstone. But if you do have specific questions, feel free to, you know, speak out, and let's nail them.
Yeah,
you know,
well, let's censor them.
Okay. All right.
Well, I mean, related to this question, I think that one thing I find interesting is that you were an urban planner. And at Sunstone, you are always talking about creating communities and things like that. And it makes me wonder if there are, like, where did your vision of community come from, and what did it contribute to Sunstone, or what has it contributed to Sunstone over the last 15 years?
That's a good question. It, I grew up in a Mormon village, you know, a very nurturing Mormon life of the church that is gone, of all those programs, and everyone knowing your name is like Anna Tefka and Fiddler on the Roof. You know, everyone knows you and cares about you, and you like each other, and it was great. I now call it like a Mormon ghetto. I find it incredible that I grew up in suburban Washington, D.C., and my entire social, intellectual, cultural life was just the ward. And we didn't know any non-Mormons, really. But it was great. And the church called out the best in me and everything I had, all aspects of my life. And I value that experience a lot. And so I came to see spirituality and life to be lived in community, and you grow in that, and it's a wonderful thing. And You know, if someone comes and taps you on the shoulder and says, it's your turn to be Scoutmaster, and it's something you would never do. And yet, you know, 10 years later, you're up at testimony meetings saying, how is the best thing that ever happened to you of your life being immersed in other people's lives and you're being stretched and so much love that you never would have had before. Those are all the great things about Mormonism, and that affected me. And I came to articulate those through Frank Capra's movies, you know, like It's a Wonderful Life and that sort of stuff. And this is, so I think a life is best lived out in community. That doesn't mean that there's a lot of dysfunctional things that happen in the community. And if you change your religion, they kick you out of Anatevka, you know, but that's, we can talk about that later on. So.
Talk to us a little bit about your concept of Sunstone in the symposium. What is it ideally supposed to be?
I've used so many different metaphors to explain that over my life here. I guess the one I've used the most is that I compare what happens at Sunstone to the conversations that happen in the 4 years of a ward. They're not sponsored by the church. They're unofficial. They're informal. And yet, that social conversation is crucial to the bonding that happens in the ward community. You need the institutional church, and you need the Sunday school classes and the sacrament meeting talks and the rituals and the sacrament. But you need more than that, too. There's always an inherent little tension between the conversations in the hallways and what happens in the institutional part. But they're the same people who are speaking over the pulpit and who are gossiping and speculating in the foyer. And even the bishop will come along and say, get to Sunday school class. You know, you're not following the program, or he'll be frustrated that you're talking about, you know, Adam God doctrine with that new convert. And, you know, they won't like the way it's happening always, but that's an inherent tension, but it's like a big study group. People get together and talk and bond, and if you've got a little intellectual bent for whatever reason, you want to discuss and understand your experience as a Mormon using critical thinking tools, and you want to express what you feel spiritually in a thoughtful way. And I see Sunstone as kind of like a study group that people organize, or those hallway conversations. That's... So I see it primarily just a place for discussion. I know a lot of other things happen at the symposium. Some people call it their church. Other people call it a community. I actually don't think Sunstone is a community in a technical sociological definition. For many people, they come to have that communal connection, but other people don't come for that. And Sunstone is a vast array of lots of different constituencies and lots of people who have different agendas. In some ways, I see it like a political party, where you've got people who have all different sorts of things, and they come together under the same tent and talk and do this sort of stuff, but there's not wide agreement always. But that's healthy, and that's good. So for me, Sunstone is a place for primarily organized by people who are Mormon, to come and explore in an honest way what it means to be Mormonism and what that is using critical tools. And they invite people who are less Mormon than they used to be, and they invite non-Mormon friends to join in the conversation. But it's primarily an intellectual forum that has the spiritual communal aspects to it. I've rambled enough on that. So. But it's not a support group, and it's not a religion, and it's not all those things.
That's ideally what Sunstone is supposed to be. A lot of people have other perceptions of what Sunstone is, some founded, some unfounded. If you were to start up an organization with a similar mission as Sunstone's, you know, without the baggage of the name and some of the history, what would you do early on in the game to perhaps head off some of the challenges the organization has seen?
Yeah, well, that's good. Inherent in that question is that we're in deep trouble right now because of what I see as polarized and politicized times that we're in. And Sunstone has a rap, sometimes not justified and sometimes justified. First of all, I think one of the things that are great about Sunstone is that we attempt, we at least we desire, and by we, I guess, I mean me, to have Sunstone be a tent, a bridge that encompasses a wide spectrum of people who have different views. From ideally, I'd like liberals and fringe people and moderates and even the conservatives all here talking and conversing together. We've never really been successful in getting many conservatives, a lot of moderates, moderate to liberal thing. That's an important bridge in and of itself. If Sunstone were to die, and I think actually there's a real chance that Sunstone could die in the next 5 to 10 years, I think it would be impossible for someone now to recreate an organization like Sunstone. You'd have probably more moderate farms kind of organization come up with a periodical, maybe more liberal activist independent organizations come up. But if someone came today and said, I want to organize something that has all of these different people in, well, people who are in those different camps would say, I don't want to be part of that. You know, I don't want to associate with those kind of people. But Sunstone's, because of its history and people's connection to it and whatever reasons, however shakily, still will associate with it. And I think that bridge is an important thing in Mormonism. And that's why Sunstone is worth preserving, because it can't be replaced if it dies. But having said that, if I was to organize it now from the beginning, I would be more cautious when we deal with controversial topics and make sure, say, if we're doing the magazine, that people in the magazine, our board is consisted of known liberals and moderates and conservatives, and the commitment of the magazine is very explicitly an open discussion where everyone's involved. And the slightest controversial issue we talk about would, within whatever context it is, be framed so that we are clearly seen as hosting a discussion rather than advocating a discussion. Whereas we present an issue and then have one side and another side talk about it and that sort of stuff.
Is that possible? I mean,
Well, not right now, because we have a hard time getting conservatives or moderates, and we don't have a lot of money and resources.
Well, you don't pay.
We don't pay.
You're reliant on what people send in.
Well, we're talking ideally, yeah. Sunstone is submission-driven, and we run into something and we say, this is an excellent article. You know, it's from a particular point of view, and we run it, and people say, oh, you're advocating that. And we take another article, and sometimes we do later on, but I think our readers actually are, on the whole, fairly unsophisticated. They don't take the
except for you.
Yeah, except for me. They don't take it as a whole. They judge it often by the particular, and that hurts us. And to develop a lightning rod against that tendency, you have to package it all in the same thing and just be very clear about doing that. But the danger of that sometimes is losing something else, which I value a lot at Sunstone. It's what I've come to call recently as the authentic voice of the individual. It's hardly a place in Mormonism where people speak of who they are. You know, the institutional forums we have, the Ensign and other things, general conference talks, they're speaking the official church position, which they should. And that should happen. I'm not saying that's wrong. Even when saints speak individually in teaching a Sunday school class, we're very conscious about how we structure what we teach in that class. We try to be creative and fun and maybe a little pushing of the envelope, but it's within the bounds of acceptability of the institution. Even when we preach sermons in sacrament meeting, we structure them to fit the pattern that is acceptable in the Orthodox institutional church. That is wonderful. That should happen. But when you hear talk at Sunstone, when you hear Jean England or Arthur Bassett or Emma Lou Thane speak, they are saying, here is me and here is how I put it together. And when you hear that voice, there is something so refreshing about the individual just saying who they are and what they're speaking. And that doesn't happen anywhere else that I know of in the public thing. Well, it happens in dialogue. But I'm speaking of that, this sort of forum, you know, and that is a valuable thing to have people say, this is me. You know, I talked to Art Bassett, who used to write articles all the time for the Ensign, and he'd hate it. He'd say, they'd call me again, and I'd say no, and then they'd offer me a check. I'd say, okay. And he'd write this article on the sacrament or on the Book of Mormon, and it comes back with all this rewriting. It comes back, and the article, he doesn't disagree with the points, but it's not Art Bassett anymore. You know, it's the church's position. And But he comes and he speaks and he gives his classic knowing, doing, being talk. And that's Art Bassett. And I celebrate that. And that's a good thing about Sunstone. No, I'm sorry.
Carrie, you had your hand up.
Yeah, Gary Bergera's question was, what are particular issues? And I think you mean topics, not necessarily magazine issues. Right. Book of Mormon historicity. Whenever we've published an article on Book of Mormon historicity, people think we're telling you, everyone, that they should not believe that the Book of Mormon is historical. And Yeah. But at one time, who'd we publish? It wasn't the one with David Wright, the Ed Firmage article, which we published, where he made an argument on that. I see it as, I take Atlantic Magazine and I read an article and I go, that's a fascinating thing. And I don't say it. If I don't believe it, I go, oh, I don't agree with this and this and this and this. When people, and I don't think it's just Mormons, but I know the Mormon experience, when Mormons read something that deals with their religion that is so important and that they believe to their correlation themselves. Oh, that's wrong, that's right, that's wrong, that's wrong, that's wrong. And they get upset, and they won't. Very few of them have the tolerance to say, that's an idea, I don't agree with it, I don't agree with it. We have a hard time. And so Book of Mormon historicity is one. I don't think you avoid... Yeah. I don't think you avoid topics. That is censorship. How you host them to allow the individual authentic voice, but also so that people do not presume that the magazine is advocating a position, is essential to the longevity of the institution. And that's a hard line to do. But you get killed even when you try. The Paul Dunn issue was a very controversial issue. What's his name? Packer. Lynn Packer did this research on Paul Dunn. And he became very personal, Lynn Packer did, because he'd researched Paul Dunn for such a long time, and Paul Dunn had stonewalled it. And the original article he wrote was just very much an attack. And Sunstone decided not to publish that because it was so personal of an attack and not just an objective reporting. And eventually the Arizona Republic did the same research and reported it. And when they did that, Sunstone decided it was an important issue and we needed to discuss it. So we reran the Arizona Republic story. We edited out a lot of the Lynn Packer's personal attacks. And there were times when in his article he'd say, Paul Dunn is just a liar, liar. And he'd say, liar, liar, pants on fire. He actually written that in the article. But he had more detail than the Arizona Republic story did, so we thought it was worthy of publishing. And then, to help people learn how to process this information, we invited 6 or 7 people from a wide array of academic perspectives and things to reflect on it and to comment on it. And then, if you live through that time, there was just all these Mormons making all these jokes about it, and cartoons were flying on faxes and stuff like that. And we thought it was important to document as being a reflective forum of the issues some of the folk humor that was going on at the time. And there I made a tragic decision. We had originally planned to have a page that says, here is the humor that was circulating. But because that section of the magazine grew to be so large with all these articles, to save space, space the cartoons out at the end of the different articles. And many people assumed that the cartoons were Sunstone Commission cartoons like the rest of the cartoons, even though had they read carefully my introductory piece, they would have known otherwise. And then they just thought, it's too much about Paul Dunn and it's overkill. And I still have people say, I'm mad at you for what you did about Paul Dunn. You put him on the cover of the magazine and it was too much. Maybe a short news story, but not that. And it was so much because we were trying to be balanced on the issue. And Sunstone paid dearly for that issue. I don't regret it except for how we packaged the cartoons. It was an important thing to do, and I think we did it responsibly. But we suffered deeply, and we may be lost in terms of people who canceled, maybe 200 subscriptions, And in terms of people who didn't renew, when it came up time to renew, we maybe lost another 300-400 subscriptions. It was a high price we paid for that issue. Yeah.
Trying to open it up to other people that seem to want to stay away.
The question is, how can we get the conservative people to participate in our forums? It's hard to do, and it's harder to do now than it used to be. After the statement on symposia, and after the excommunications of the September 6th and others. To invite a conservative to speak, because we used to have an occasional conservative. They wouldn't be a regular participant at the symposium, but if there was an issue that they were particularly interested in, they may say, yeah, I'll come and do that. Not a lot, but some. And but now, if you're not a regular participant in Sunstone, even if you're moderate, not necessarily conservative, you say, I'll come and speak at Sunstone or I'll write for Sunstone, the climate makes them feel that they're making a statement about who they are in Mormonism and in the church by doing something with Sunstone. So it's a much more high psychological price people pay, and it's a wall. It's no longer just a line they casually cross over. It's a wall they have to kind of hurdle over psychologically to join Sunstone, and that's hard. As the distance between the statement and symposia, the time grows longer, and if Sunstone tries to make a track record, we can regain that, but it's a slow thing. And partly the rhetoric that Stan Christensen, our chair, has done to say Sunstone is faithful, Sunstone is committed Mormons, and the way he has said that has unnerved a lot of the people who attend the symposium. But in terms of the larger public relations effect to the larger audience, that's very helpful to us. If that crossed over to censorship, then I think we'd be in trouble. But if we want to regain some of those people, we have to do some aggressive persuasion that they are welcome here and they are not joining with people who are trying to undermine the church, and that church leaders will not disapprove of them by coming here. You know, it's a very hard thing. Well, you guys can decide whether we take questions or...
Go ahead, Becky.
There's always been a tension, you know, from before the first issue came out. Scott Kenney met with his old mission president, Elder Packer, who had concerns about Sunstone. Yeah. Oh, excuse me. The question was, how did times get politicized and polarized, and are they getting worse or are they getting better? And things that, there's always been a thing. When I came to work at Sunstone in 1982 and the Sunstone Review, you look back at that from now where we are, you know, those are really mild days. But Sunstone was suspicious then, and people were saying, oh, it's liberal, it's this and this, and anyone who reads those things now will say, this is mild. But as Mormon intellectual studies began primarily with history, and is still rooted in history with the Mormon History Association, and we had the wars with the historians and the Church Historians Office in the early 80s. What you saw with Sunstone was saying, we're going to be a magazine, an intellectual magazine that's going to deal with all sorts of things. And being a magazine rather than a journal, we're going to try to reach a larger popular audience. And so we're going to bring in other disciplines, and we're going to bring in personal opinions, and we're going to bring in personal perspectives. And because Sunstone tries to be a popular forum, it got more attention and it got more publicity, and particularly that's true with the symposium. And journalism, by its nature, covers conflict. Salt Lake Tribune doesn't go and write a news story on the Pillars of My Faith session, but they will go cover a story where people are criticizing some policy or there's some debate. It's just the bias of journalism. It covers conflict dance, covers what's new. And so people who read their newspaper will say, oh, there's Sunstone. And look at all these people. They're criticizing the church. And from reading those individual articles, and those articles are not about the symposium. Those articles are about a person who's giving a talk at the symposium. They're reporting on a particular talk. And they're not presuming to give the reader a whole feel of the symposium. They're presuming to give them a summary of one particular paper. But what the reader takes from reading these several news stories is, oh, Sunstone is where people get together and criticize the church. Even though most of the things talked about Sunstone are pretty faithful and many of them could be given that church. But that impression goes on and on, and eventually people say, no, enough is enough, and they issue a statement on the symposia. And then other people feel that they have to enforce that. And so we have, as a result of the statement symposia, whereas BYU professors at their height, how many spoke at a symposium?
Well, before the symposium, there was 60, I think, and then the next year there was 30.
Yeah.
So it dropped in half, and it's dropped in half every
right.
year.
We had over 100.
I don't think so. I think 60 was the highest. But that's a lot. I used to organize those symposiums, and it was very easy to call BYU faculty and say, you know, we've got this paper on something in some obscure field, and this is what you teach. Would you come and respond? And many of them did nothing in Mormon studies, but this was in their field, and they'd say, sure, I'll come and respond. And they could casually agree to respond. That's impossible now. You know, losing, we now have maybe 5 BYU faculty who will speak at any one symposium, contrasted to 60. Those 55 moderates' voices, and also fairly good scholars, were hard to replace, and we haven't been able to replace them. And so the balance of Sunstone tips to the more liberals, and we're becoming marginalized, which we weren't before, and it also tips to we had a balance between scholars and non-scholars, and it's a nice blend that people from other religious traditions envy, that what happens here at Sunstone. And Dick Ostling, who's written in Time magazine for years, he was a religion editor of Time magazine. He was here last summer, and he just says, I don't know of any other religion where average members get together and talk about this. You know, at Sunstone, it's the vitality of people at Sunstone who actually care about these issues. They're just not a bunch of academics talking about them. They're people who are passionate. It's incredible and impressive. But that lay scholarly balance is an important one to keep, and losing the BYU element tips it to some degree in terms of the amateur. And that's a hard thing to deal with because, frankly, we have a lot of amateurs here in Sunstone who because they speak on a panel that also has scholars and sociologists and people, they begin to think that they know more than they do. And that's a problem, too. But so anyhow, that gets off. But we do get that with the church and perimeter, with the excommunications, makes it very hard. I think the reason I think Sunstone may die is because very few organizations live a really long time. If you think of the number of periodicals that were here 100 years ago, that are here today, there aren't many. Periodicals are organized to address the needs and interests of the people at the time. And they do that. And then society changes and people have different interests. And it's very hard for a periodical to change and keep up with those because they've got an established constituency, and it's hard to keep that constituency seen and also to change with where society is going. And in the meantime, someone comes along and says, oh, you're just interested in that, and we're really interested in this, so we'll start a new publication. And so a new publication comes along, and eventually this one can't live, and it dies, and that's change, and that's progress, and that's good. I mean, just look at computer magazines and how, you know, they shift with the changes and stuff, and very few things are able to continue. And if you look at the people who organized Sunstone in 1974, they were a pretty homogenous, believing kind of group of people. And there wasn't this whole contingent of, and the issues they dealt with were relatively non-threatening to the church, even though a lot of people in the church. But since then, feminists have even become more radicalized, and the gay agenda has come on board, and there's been a lot more bigger issues that are more divisive in the church, and a lot of people who who now say, I'm not really that active in the church, but I'm involved in talking about the church. And that's a very different constituency. So the spectrum of where people are and their ideas or stuff have changed so much. You know, we're not the same group we were 20 years ago. And to think Sunstone still can address those and try to keep its historical commitments as well as to do this, and times and interests are changing. You know, magazines have a life, and Sunstone eventually may say, and it's happening. You know, the number of people who no longer subscribe to Sunstone or come to the symposium. And when we talk to them, we send them a letter and say, come back and tell us why. Not many of them write back, but all of those who do write back say something like, oh, I'm no longer interested in those issues. And some of them say, I'm back in the church, the intellectual things no longer concern me. Or, I'm out of Mormonism. Good luck what you're doing. But people change. And at the same time, because of the brand put on Sunstone right now, it's hard to get new people to replace them. And so we're in a bad dynamic of not replacing them, and we're not getting young people to replace all you old people here. You know, the Gen X people... Yeah. The Gen X people who are intellectual and interested in intellectual issues... There's a pattern with them which has been observed by many people. When they leave BYU and they're in the honors program and they work for student review and stuff, they go off to graduate school and they run into the tension with what they think intellectually and the tension with that and the institutional church as they perceive it in their ward and stuff. They exit. They exit Mormonism and they leave, which was just not a menu, just not really an option on the menu of the baby boomer generation. You know, most of them stuck with it in some way, somehow. And they still see themselves as DNA Mormons, as Michael Quinn calls himself. Well, Gen Xers just saying, oh, it's not worth it, I'm out of here. And so, like, Sunstone may not be appealing even to intellectuals who want a liberal, sort of broad-based discussion and who are willing to tolerate different views within Mormonism. It may be a periodical because of the dynamics of Mormonism that are always changing that will no longer address any audience substantially enough to support it. That's a real possibility.
Albert, I want to ask about the change that you're talking about, especially the last 15 years, and sort of be historical. I mean, I want you to try to create a narrative of change in the church in general, in Sunstone as a symposium and a magazine while you've been the editor, in the Mormon intellectual community that is larger than Sunstone, and number four, you, your own person, your own 15-year journey. And I want you to try to put those narratives together and say what has happened in the last 15 years that brings us to a point of crisis. I mean, it's hard not to view everything sort of refracted backwards through the September 6th, but I want to know, like, what was the atmosphere in 1987 before Dallin Oaks gives the alternate voices talk? I mean, people now say, oh, there's a dot-to-dot, alternate voices, to this, to this, to this, to this, but I want to know what it was like going through it without knowing what the end is.
Yeah. He graded on grammar as well as style.
The polarized times and the dynamics we're talking about were there before the September 6th. You know, in 1987, 88, the late 80s, as best as I can recall, there were some fiery sessions. You know, Paul Toscano was speaking and people would like to go to them and hear him do his latest thing. And there were, back then, we had a lot of feminist sessions. We had so many feminist women's sessions that... And we tried to space them out one per time period. We had more than we had time periods, and we'd have to double book women's sessions. And that was a time when lots of women were very excited about talking about these topics, and they were still concerned about doing them within Mormonism. But because they were talking about those topics, there was the sense that people were, you know, there were even then some BYU professors who would say, I'm not sure Sunstone deals with the same sort of issues I'm interested in, you know, a committed Mormon talking about these things. And I'd have to lobby them very hard to say, I think most of Sunstone and most of the people are interested in speaking as a believing saint about these issues, which I firmly believed and still believe. But it was easy for people even back then to come to the conclusion that the people who they encountered at Sunstone were not the people who were of common interest in terms of about the church and about their beliefs. Part of that is the people who comment from the audience are generally the malcontents. You know, at plenary sessions, the people get up and voice their opinions are always disturbed and angry. You know, you don't have, you know, the Leonard Arringtons and the Dean Mays and all those people making very many comments. It's the people who are more disturbed, and that's understandable for that reason. And secondly is we're lazy intellectuals. We like controversy, and we go to controversy. That Cal Grondahl cartoon that shows, you know, person giving a presentation in one symposium room, you know, the whole universe unified into one whole, and here's the truth, you know. There's one person in the audience, and a fly is buzzing through the room. And the next one is, you know, incomes of the general authorities, and the room is packed, you know, and overflowing. That's true, you know. You know, Paul Toscano never gave any of his famous sessions in a plenary session, you know. And yet, there were five other papers being given at the same time. And very good, solid papers. One of the things that frustrates people is that we put, as they say, all the good papers at the same time. Well, we put all the popular authors at the same time. That's a matter of crowd control. You know, you got to spread them out. And it's also guaranteeing that people are going to have an audience. But, and the side benefit is that they buy tapes. But we're lazy intellectuals. We'll go to hear a sensational topic rather than a good, solid paper on history or something. And some of my favorite papers, you know, people just don't do that. Or, and this is a sad commentary, which I mentioned the other night, and Peggy Fletcher commiserates in it when she was here. We don't go hear non-Mormons speak. We are not interested in hearing non-Mormons speak. They can be the best person in the world on their topic. And, well, I've never heard of them, and they're not talking about Joseph Smith and plural wives, and we don't go. And, you know, I really actually, as much as I love everyone individually, collectively as a group of people, I have a high level of disdain for us. I think we are lazy intellectuals. And we bring in a scholar, and it takes a little bit of attention to pick up a few words of vocabulary so we can follow their talk, and it's really no more of a demand than is asked of a freshman going to hear a lecture, and I get people saying, these talks are too heavy, I don't want a speaker like that, that's boring. We're not it appeals to Mormonism so much. It's because it's a story, it's a narrative. Something that's more abstract, we're not really that interested in it. There are other reasons why history appeals to Mormonism, because we're history-based religion and that sort of stuff. But
I want to pull you back.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, I got off. Okay.
I want to know, in 1985, when you're in the middle of, this is before you were here, but you're in the middle of Hoffman and you're crowding rooms with a plenary session talking about Mark Hoffman, and you have Jan Shipps and Richard Bushman and all these people talking about this stuff. I mean, I've listened to the tapes to these sessions. The audience must have been, I don't know, huge compared to opening sessions now. Is there any way to know in 1985 that 10 years later you would have had September 6th and people who were so involved then, you know, either having left the church or been kicked out of the church? Or was there any way to know when you showed up on the doorstep with Daniel that 3 years later your temple recommends would be pulled for publishing a news story in the magazine? I want to slow down and move through this process.
Oh, thanks. Well, if you take a long hindsight and the church and its dealings with independent organizations and intellectuals, I think anyone could have said, okay, we're heading to a confrontation. You know, we always have. You know, contrary to these people our dean's age, who talk about the golden time of the church where it was open to intellectual and stuff, I don't believe that. I point to me the time, you know. In the 40s and 50s, we were beating up on Juanita Brooks and and Fawn Brody, and in the 30s and 40s we were beating up on E.E. Erickson and Heber Schnell, and in the 20s and teens we were beating up on the Chamberlains, and the Godbeites before that, and William Law and the Expositor and Nauvoo. I mean, there has never been a time in Mormonism that I can see where the church has valued independent discussion in Mormonism. So there is going to be a tension, and someone could have looked at that. Nevertheless, and that session that you mentioned about Mark Hoffman, the session wasn't about Mark Hoffman. The session was about Joseph Smith, because several important books had come out about Joseph Smith, and they had invited Richard Bushman and Jan Shipps, because both of their books had recently come out, and some other Smith scholars. But Hoffman was in the air, and Hoffman was everywhere, and Jan Shipps did the first public discussion of the Salamander letter at that session. So it was a very hot session, which everyone was abuzz. But it was, technically, we didn't schedule a session on Hoffman's stuff. But those were heady times. I mean, every symposium and every MHA you would go to is like, what new document? And what does this mean about Mormonism? And we have to reevaluate Mormonism. And then Salamander came in the air, and everyone's doing magic. And Ron Walker's doing magic at BYU. And Michael Quinn does his magic. And there was a time, and then people were beginning to say their things, and there were people coming to the symposium to hear them say their things, and there was like, oh, we're free, we can do this, we can do this. And there are boundaries, and there are limits. And I know now some apostles explain what happened with the statement on symposia to see where we're heading on that, as it was not an attempt to shut down Sunstone, it was an attempt to say there are boundaries and limits, and here they are, and to outline them, and to provide cautions and counsel. Which that's healthy. That's the job of the institution to do that. So I think, to some degree, we were not as responsible and careful as we needed to be. But I see all this as a learning experience. We are juveniles in learning how to have independent discussion in Mormonism, partly because Mormonism doesn't learn how to do it. And to some degree, we throw temper tantrums here at Sunstone. And I see that as it's going to take a long time, both for the institutional church and for the independent sector, to learn how to behave as adults with independent discussion. But we'll never learn without experimenting and trying. But we couldn't have seen that at the time. People did not see this as something that was coming. You know?
When did you see it coming?
Maybe when my stake president called me in and took my recommend away. or Elder Oaks' alternate voices talked in 89. Yeah. But we'd always hear, even before that, we'd hear reports through back channels. You know, we publish an Ed Firmage Sr.'s article on the last final years of Hubie Brown after he was put back in the quorum from the first presidency after the death of David McKay. And they're not happy years, and they show some infighting among the 12. And it was a fine article, I think. I'm not embarrassed about having published it. But I heard a report that the 12 read it and were furious about the article because they did not appreciate and they do not want any discussion of the internal workings of the Quorum of the 12. First of all, those, you know, had we not known somebody who knew somebody in the 12, I would have never even got that story. So, it's communication problems between the independent sector and the institutional church are need refining. But we'd hear those sorts of things, or they'd read something else, and John Ashton, whose father was an apostle, said, would always say to us, just don't send them the magazine. Just quit sending them Sunstone. They just get mad every time they read it. There's something in it. And I would say to him, being a naive intellectual, no, they can't be involved in the independent discussion. At least they should be able to overhear it and know what people are talking about and what they're concerned about. And he'd say, that's not how they read it. They just read it, And then we'd get reports. They'd say, yes, there are good things in Sunstone. Yes, there are important articles. This Hugh Nibley thing, this Lobenya thing. But there are also bad things in Sunstone. There's good and there's bad. What do we do about Sunstone? I think it's the nature of the general authorities to figure, we have to do something. It's our job to do something. And so they eventually do something, and they don't know what to do with the good and the bad. But eventually we have a hard time accepting as they perceive bad stuff. And so I see it. These are growing pains that may take 100 years for Mormonism to even have a comfortable balance with the tension.
Can you tell us about your own growing pains in these 15 years?
Yeah, yeah. Which pain do you want to know about?
Let's start with the two times you fell through the light table at Sunstone.
You remember them better than I do.
Oh, do I?
Yeah. Yeah, my own journey. You're asking about my faith journey, probably. I came to Sunstone already having gone through several periods of disillusionment, finding Mormon history not to be the way I thought it was, finding church leaders not to be the people who I thought they were, and I'd ask myself, what does this tell me about how God works among Mormons, among people? And I would see a much more human layer, a much more God allowing us to do a lot of different things rather than God directing everything. So I came to Sunstone with that, but still very much a believer in God and God acting in history through Joseph Smith, even though it's complicated, and it's healthy to learn about that through history and through organizational studies. And the more we can learn about that, that's all to the good. A very much enlightenment perspective. And I think personally it's been a large toll. I believe now much less. Almost nothing. Sometimes I don't believe anything. Other times there are glimmers. That's partly the price you pay for being a person who's a facilitator. Like myself, I used to go down to BYU once a week and drop in on faculty and talk with them. And I have lots of friends, still have lots of friends down there. And it's very interesting to see how each of them would talk about the church, because they're all very orthodox, except usually in the area of their discipline. And then they'd say, I don't think the church is quite right on this. This is the way things should be. And they were extraordinarily liberal and progressive and open and sometimes directly contradictory of some aspect of the church. But it's very easy for them because all they really thought about was this one area. And then they accepted the received tradition on everything else. So I'd go talk to a historian or organizational person or English person and different things. And by the end of the day, I've heard 10 different places where people believe that the church is wrong, but they all believe everything is right on the other thing, you know. And that's just happy for them, and they don't feel the need to go around preaching that. You know, they're fine just talking about it with their faculty members for me. But for me, I have in that day revised 10 aspects of my theology where they believe I dealt with one, you know. And you do that enough times that you just go, you know, the center is no longer holding because everything is so different. And so that has been personally a challenge for me because I am somewhat this facilitator. I like people. I like hearing the ideas and assimilating things, and those are aspects of my personality that help me do my job well. And I like people and hearing them, but they also that assimilation, joining things makes me what some people think are just a very mushy person, and it's because I'm very tentative at best in what I believe. I don't know if I really want in this forum to push me on point by point, because on good days I'm what Larry Young at BYU calls a hopeful agnostic, and but I still encounter the church pleasantly and charitably, even if I believe personally very little in terms of being absolute faith tenets.
I'd like you to respond to a couple of your critics. We've raised a couple of issues that have been playing out over last few years in Sunstone, the gay issue, the feminist issue. Last year, the Deseret News reported that Sunstone was basically a gay-themed symposium.
If Oral Roberts knew about Sunstone, he would say tornadoes were going to strike Salt Lake City.
The Deseret News, they didn't say that, did they?
No.
Oh, didn't remember that.
They did say the gay-themed. Respond.
Yeah, well, first of all, that reporter was stupid. You know, he came... But Paul Swenson's a good reporter, but most reporters are stupid. I'll get off on this. A major in journalism should be abolished. It is the worst thing in the world. They're taught how to write news stories, but they really don't know how to make sense of things. You know, what they need to do is have a good general education with a good dose of sociology and things so they can enter in and have a sense of how things play out and this sort of stuff. And so they know how to interpret and understand what processes, human processes, and what's going on. And they don't. They get facts and they don't. Anyhow, that's an aside.
An unappreciated aside.
Answer the question.
We package our gay sessions, we bundle them together in a track, usually on Saturday, because unlike our women's sessions, which have to be spread out all the time, and unlike other things, which we try not to put things that have a common interest and in the same session, but we can put them on any day because most of the people who are going to be attending will attend the whole thing. A lot of people who are interested in gay sessions will only come for the gay sessions, so we're kind enough not to make them have to come Thursday morning and Friday night and Saturday afternoon. We give them a little track that they can come. So we usually have about 5 or 6 gay sessions total out of 100 or so. But he came and looked at the program and saw all these gay sessions and said, "I see homosexuality is a major theme of the symposium." I said, "No, but the response is Sunstone is a reflective forum. It reflects the issues of the day, and to the extent that homosexuality becomes an issue that's being discussed in the larger American society, you're going to see people wanting to understand that within their Mormon context, and so there will be proposals for that at the symposium. And you can track that on many issues, you know. Child abuse and spouse abuse becomes an interest in American society, and you see the number of sessions in Sunstone grow with the number of times that it's on the cover of Time magazine, and then you can see the number of times it drops, and same with women's issues, and same with, I mean, we reflect the issues. People come to Sunstone because they want to be able to understand these issues in their Mormon context. But actually, with the gay thing, I'm pretty sensitive about it. Being gay myself, I don't want to be seen as riding that hobby horse. So I don't go on my way to organize gay sessions. I pretty well welcome good ones that come in, and we accept them. But that's one we're sensitive about, knowing that we're going to allow the discussion, but we're not going to let Sunstone be taken over in terms of its reputation, because that would help kill the organization. But it's one of many topics that are welcome here, and we accept the proposals.
To talk about another group, feminists. Sunstone's been criticized for being sometimes not that hospitable to feminist discussion. Any truth to that?
When people say that, they generally mean Elbert is not hospitable to...
I didn't want to say that. Thank you.
I think Sunstone, particularly the symposium, has a very good record of dealing with feminist issues. The magazine has dealt with it less so. To some extent, that's submission-driven. And to some extent, that's our aggressiveness on doing that. People will present both papers. People who publish in the Mormon Women's Forum have on occasion come to me and said, "I'd like to republish that article in Sunstone." And I tell them, not a prayer. We won't republish an article that's appeared in the Mormon community. We won't republish an article that appeared in Dialogue or Mormon Women's Forum or Exponent 2 because they're accessible to people. If it's an article that appears in something that's really obscure, like that most of our readers wouldn't read, like AMCAP journal or some sociological journal or some history journal, but that's just a policy I have. And so they're frustrated at that, but they're naive. I just... I think Sunstone's published a lot. The truth of the matter is, We haven't been obsessed with it. We've published a lot of Marie Cornwall on this topic and other women's. The number of sessions that deal exclusively with feminist and women's issues has dramatically dropped in the last 5 years or more. And I attribute that more to a success than a lack of interest. Like you take the current issue. This is an article by Jana Rees on Mormon Kitsch, which is a great article, and it's a wonderful example of where we need to go with women's issues. In the past, if you would have taken out of Sunstone Magazine or Sunstone Symposium the women who were speaking on women's issues, and just look at the women involved in the discussion of other Mormon issues, it's minuscule, you know, almost none. The discussion of women's issues was an important one that needed to be discussed, and no one else was paying attention to it, and so the women needed to do that. But it was also a way that brought women into Mormon studies as a whole. They're frustrated in feminism, and they come and get involved in those discussions, and then they branch out. Jana Rees writes an article based upon material culture and Kitsch, and she talks about that in Mormonism. She also talks, it's informed by feminist studies, and she uses feminist scholarly tools to analyze a Mormon Kitsch at times, but she also uses other skills. So feminist studies are no longer isolated, but they're integrated, and you see that with a lot of men, too. So in the sense of Sunstone now having particular articles on feminism, we're not having some, but we have more and more of our articles have feminist approaches integrated into them as a whole, and I think you see that in the symposium, too. And that's all to the credit. And women aren't being... There's a lot more women involved in non-women's topics, which we need more of.
And a lot of people who were involved in these discussions are beaten out of
that's
Mormonism.
Right. Yeah, a lot of those other women are just tired of the topic. Yeah, I was actually surprised this year to see several women who were involved a lot in the past who hadn't been here for years back this year. Yeah.
Let's just talk personally now for a second. There's been emails passed around and things posted on discussion boards about some current problems with your stake president. What do you want to tell us?
They are all hearsay and rumor. What year was my temple recommend taken?
90.
It
was the temple change.
Right. Yeah, this is an example of where something gets us in trouble. When the church made changes in the temple endowment, when they eliminated the penalties and other things, it was widely reported in the media. And Sunstone doesn't publish a lot of original news, as those of you who read the magazine. And some of the only original news we write is telling you how the media covered certain things. And that was a story we wrote, is Church didn't announce these changes, but the media found out, and it was reported widely, and we reported that, we were trying to be very careful, we reported that some newspapers gave explicit descriptions of the penalties, such as the LA Times and Arizona Republic, but we went out of our way not to quote those explicit descriptions, we just said that they did that. But then in the process, every Mormon who gave a positive quote, and all the Mormon quotes were positive, about the changes in the temple endowment were all called in, such as Keith Norman and Ross Peterson, editor of Dialogue. He had his temple recommend taken for giving a positive quote. We reported that fact in that news story as an important thing to report. And Sunstone was the only place that I know of that it was reported. Shortly thereafter, my stake president called me in and told me that for running that story, for some time he had been concerned about me and Sunstone, but for running that story I had crossed the line and he took my temple recommend. I asked him if this was him or if he'd been told, and he after several questions, it was clear he said this was his own action and he had not been instructed to do this by anyone. Well, 3 days later, Daniel Rector was president, who he was the publisher at the time, did the same thing, stake president did the same thing to him, and you know, this is more than a coincidence. And later, through a casual conversation with our area president, he offhandedly mentioned that the decision to take my recommend had come from above him. So my stake president lied, and that sort of was the end of it. I no longer had a recommend, and that was in 90, and a couple of years ago now, I guess 2 years ago, my new stake president called me in and said, my file had been passed on to him as unfinished business, and because they never resolved this recommend thing, and he looked at it and was concerned that by what I did at Sunstone and running the symposium and publishing the magazine might constitute apostasy, and maybe there should be further church action. Since then, I've been involved in lengthy conversations with that stake president and his successor about that. No action. There have been no disciplinary councils action taken, although there's been some discussed about. And we're in an ongoing conversation, which, in spite of some close friends letting it slip and it getting spread around the internet, I have kept out of the media and kept it off the press. And I prefer to keep these conversations private at the moment, as I think they should be. So that's sort of where it is.
You just talked briefly about the fact that Stan, as chairman of the board, has stated that he wants kind of a kinder, gentler symposium. And I've talked to a few people in, you know, just the day that I've been here, and some of them have come up and said, you know, hey, we presented proposals to for papers or panels this year that, you know, were reasonable, and they've been rejected. And, you know, that's never happened before. And what's happening to Sunstone? Is it turning into this milquetoast, moderate, you know, boring organization? Talk to me. Help me. Please.
Okay.
Respond.
I can't think of a session that we rejected because of its content, because of the topic and the issue that it was dealing with. Without a person's permission, I wouldn't want to talk about anyone's particular proposal. But I think that's true.
That's a lot like the church. Who's being protected here?
The person who presented the proposal. Because I would say it was shoddy scholarship. You know, they're right. Sessions.
You would say that?
Yes. Well, let me finish.
What makes you be the judge of shoddy scholarship?
Okay, that's a fair question.
Isn't this our organization? Don't we buy in? Don't we pay money? Don't we donate?
But it
subscription
is
dollars.
Yes, all is true, and we need more.
Strike that from the record, please.
It is true. There are sessions that may have been accepted 5 years ago that we did not accept now. I see that as improving our standards. Rejecting something because you don't think it's up to snuff in terms of scholarship is not censorship. That's judgment and having standards. Censorship is saying that topic or that person is off limits all the way. I continually believe Sunstone needs to incrementally improve its level of discourse, both in terms of its scholarship and in terms of its tone. And it's something we continually work on and try to encourage. And so there have been sessions that we have rejected. We do that every year, and we'll reject more. And so I don't apologize for any of the ones we rejected. In terms of my being the judge, well, that's why you hire, that's why you read a magazine. Anyone who's ever tried to surf something on the internet knows how frustrating it is to go through so much junk before you find something good. The reason I take the New Yorker magazine is because I like the judgment of the editors, and they do the screening for me. And that's my job as editor and as a symposium organizer, is to do that screening so that you come and feel that quality stuff is here for your money, and you don't have to have this, you know, register beware. Go into the room at your own risk. And I think I feel very comfortable about my judgments. I've been here for 13 years, and I know the Mormon community, and I talk to them. I have a sense of values, and I'm a generalist who, because of my experience, has a sense of disciplines and where we're going and what's good and who's considered good and who's considered to be a shoddy scholar. And I make mistakes. I'm human, and I'll make them. But and people can appeal to the board committee that supervises if they don't like the decisions. And I would like to actually have a committee work more on this. I'd love to delegate the running of a symposium to it. But here's what it would require. It would require a person willing to sign up to be on a committee to meet one night a week for 3 months, and then to take a lot of assignments to make tons of phone calls afterward. You know, I have plenty of people who say to me, I'd like to be on the screening committee to accept the proposals that come in. Well, the fact is, it's a myth that people think that we just sit there and the proposals come in and we pick and choose between them. Most of you here know that we call you, myself, or the person who we hire to help us, call a million people. We sit down and print out our computer printout of the usual suspects, and we beat the bushes and say, you know, Scott Kenny, do you have a paper you can present? He says, oh, maybe I do. Call me back in a month. You know, call Scott back in a month, you know. Or call someone else and say, well, I'm not sure I'll be in town. We may have a family vacation. You know, let us know. You know, we'll call you back when we know our travel plans. Of course, then we have to call them back. And we call and call and call and call. So most of our work is not in rejecting and censoring. It's in recruiting and beating the bushes to get people involved. And it's a high-level amount of time. And you know, most people aren't willing to do that on a volunteer basis. But we'd welcome anyone who wants to help.
Albert, we have one more quick thing, and then we want to let the audience ask the last sets of questions. There's about 15 minutes left, so we should divide that in half, I think. We just want to know, but Brian gets to answer one of these, I think. We want to know sort of favorite moments, highlights, last 15 years. I'm curious to hear about the time where masturbation became a subject in a Washington, D.C. symposium.
I remember that. What was it?
But I want to hear, like, what are some of the things, some of those moments, some of the things you might not do again. I want to know about the biggest typos in the magazine. Stupid little things like that that are kind of funny.
I can respond to the typo.
This happened in the first magazine that I put together as managing editor, and it was Jack Newell's article, Scarecrows, Scapegoats and Scarecrows, and in the first sentence, which we always put in an initial cap to draw the reader in, he's talking about, you know, public viewing of, you know, whatever it was he was talking about, and we changed it to pubic viewing. You know, if you know of Jack, he's the greatest guy, and, you know, we saw that the minute it came out. Victor found it, actually, and gleefully ran around and showed everyone. We called Jack up, and he was really good about it. But that's probably the biggest typo that I personally was responsible for, and Albert by proxy.
I don't even like you were going to say something?
No, just I want to know your moments.
I don't know, it's hard to bring them up, but when something comes up, I remember that, oh, I remember that.
I'm bringing up the masturbation reference.
That was a session I presented at the symposium. What was it on?
It was in D.C. I don't know, I wasn't there. I just hear about it. Do you remember the time when Albert made this big confessional about masturbation?
I think it was a talk on what is Mormon spirituality. And the talk was not on masturbation. That was a passing example that I made. And
it was a memorable one, too.
No, I hardly remember. I can't really remember the details. I'm sorry. But we can get the tape, though. It was recorded.
That's right. You sang that song in the hollow of his hand. He grows from boy to man. Something else. That was something else.
Generally, the favorite moments for me, there are talks that I've heard or articles I've read that deeply move me. And there are sometimes you get an author that you're so proud of and you're happy to have it come out. But there's this creative side of me which, you know, you try to make these associations, like with the symposium, you know, someone's giving this paper and you're really glad about it. You think, this would be the perfect response. And you're kind of creating something, or you're creating pillars or where these three people would be perfect resonance against each other, and because you have diversity of gender and position and stuff, and yet they would still make a wonderful evening. And there's this creative thing of trying to envision something that would work with the diversity and balance and resonance and stuff. And then when you watch it happen and it does, you just go, yes, that's wonderful. More often than not, I'm going, yeah, it sort of worked, but had we done this? I'm a pretty self-critical, analytical person in that process. But overall, that creative playing is what is very enjoyable for me.
Do you have a single moment that stands out above others?
Well, yes, but I can't remember. I mean, you could help me. You heard me. Or Eric could tell me. Eric never remembers. That's why I can tell him anything.
What about the other time where you go, no?
Yeah, there are lots of those.
I mean, you don't want to say in public?
I wouldn't want to mention anyone's name, but there are... I'm a pretty harsh critic of things, and there's hardly a thing in the magazine or the symposium which, if I don't look back, even if I say it was wonderful, I don't wince and say, we should have done this, or we should have done this, and it would have been better had we done this than we had done this. And there's very few things where I just perfect.
Open it up. Questions? Come up to the mic. Albert, you talked about the future of Sunstone, but in very vague terms, as in it might die at some point, theoretically, and so forth. What do you see in the next, say, 3 years, more specifically? What issues do you see coming into the intellectual community that might not be here yet, but are on their way? And then also about the organization itself. Do you see it existing for 3 more years, 10 more years, 20 more years? What are your best guesses?
Behind that question is, am I staying at Sunstone? Is that what you're trying to ask?
Also, job security. He's your managing
manager. Yeah. Right. So, you're not that. You want the larger intellectual issues. Yeah. I don't know. I think I don't know what topics are coming. If I do, they don't come to me at mind. Things I personally would like to experiment more is to be able to take contemporary issues in society and find good Mormons who can reflect on them. And I think something that the magazine can do better and more of that I think readers would like would be able to provide for people ways to help understand and approach, or at least look at the world using their Mormon categories of understanding and values. So taking more contemporary issues, whether it's be the debate over Titanic or the war in Kosovo, and say, as we Mormons, should we, using our Mormonism, what should we think about this or feel about it or do about it? And I would prefer to host several views at a time, so none of them say this is the Mormon view. But I'd like to have Sunstone be much more of a contemporary reflective voice where Mormons, through it, Mormons engage the world rather than just our own experience. But that I don't know where Sunstone's going to go in 10 years. Where I've been in pushing Sunstone is for it to be continually more and more of an accessible, popular, intellectual magazine, which means the Atlantic Monthly for Mormonism. So we want to have articles that aren't too long, with lots of call-outs, more illustrations, short things that engage people. So if a person flipping through and doesn't want to read a long article, they can find short things which engage them, are fun, and are worthy enough, so they get through the magazine and say, that was really great. I liked it, even if they didn't read everything in it. And for one reason, they keep subscribing. And that means we have diversity of perspectives so that people aren't interested in this, but they're interested in this, or something a little faithful, something a little more skeptical, something this, something that. And I hope there's enough readers who have that tolerance, who want to have that diversity in the magazine. And I want us to continue to tweak and push the formats so that so it's not just a bunch of words and columns and stuff, and the same sort of things, but they're just... In the writing style, there are different ways to engage us, and they're fun, as well as the play of topics and ideas. That's hard to do because we don't pay our authors. We're submission-driven, and we have a very small staff, and whatever we do, we have to do in very small increments. But even in the 13 years that I've been here, if you look at an early magazine and look at it now, you can see a much higher level of sophistication in what we're doing about than we did there. So you can make progress.
My question is for the Bryans. I want to know from the perspective of the Young Turks of Mormon scholarship, journalism, what is there hope that younger people rising out of the ranks are going to step into Sunstone and revitalize it, and is there hope that... That you guys are going to continue to play a part, maybe a stronger part, but from your generation, what's going to happen?
I don't know about generation because I'm always surprised to see a lot of new young people at the symposium and not people that are my associates. And so it used to be that. I used to feel like I would come to the symposium and there would be like five people under, well, at the time I started coming, maybe like five people under 25. And I knew them all. They were my friends. We all drove up in the same car or something. And I see lots of young people who I don't know and who I don't think come out of the usual, you know, they're not part of like the student review to Sunstone track. So I think that those people are making lots of contributions, and I have no idea if they will step in and take over Sunstone or, you know, lead it into the next millennium or whatever. But I think that the difficulty for me personally was that I worked for Sunstone during a really difficult part of its history and of Mormon history, and that the costs are too high and I would never be willing to do it. And that I may not come back to Sunstone after, if Elbert decided to leave in a number of years, I may not come back. In part because my association at this point is personal and not necessarily intellectual. And that's just because I took a hell of a beating. I had enough experiences with stake presidents calling me in when I was an undergraduate at BYU, and having those kind of experiences, I have no desire to do that for the rest of my life. And I don't want to be Mike Quinn when I'm Mike Quinn's age. I don't want to have to be telling the newspaper, I'm a Mormon, damn it, believe me. I don't. So that's my personal.
We don't have a lot of time. I'm going to go ahead and defer to other questions.
You didn't say you got cards. Gary?
Okay. Well, you alluded here, and also in some of your editorials, to your own crises of faith and to your own dark nights of the soul, things like that, both at the Seventh East Press and then later at the Sunstone Review. And then 13 years ago, you did decide to come back to Sunstone, and you've stayed here for 13 years. Why have you stayed the past 13 years, considering that these past 13 years have probably been harder than anything you had to deal with before that?
That's a great question.
Yeah, I don't experience them personally as hard. Maybe it's just the crisis of faith that I had when I was at Seventh East Press. It was maybe my first one, and that my whole world was shaken, and that. This one, so much of the sadness has been external, friends and the church I love, which I would hope sometimes would be different, but I still think it's incredible. But there have been, as everyone has, what do I believe now, what do I think, and we all go through those. I think the reason I've stayed is just because I'm lazy, and the inertia, you know. had someone come along on several occasions and offered me a job, I probably would have taken it at the right. It had to be at the right moment, but I would have done that. And there were times then when I stayed because I felt if I left, Sunstone may not live, and it's important, and I did stay for that. There are parts of it I love, and now I'm up the point. I've come to the conclusion that if I choose to leave Sunstone, and it dies, it dies, and I don't feel any weight to stay to keep Sunstone alive. But I used to feel that. What I love about it is the people, the association, the play of the ideas, taking ideas.